9.5 FM. I'm Phil Taylor. With me is Phil Conlon. How are you doing, Phil?
Good afternoon, Phil.
We're going to be talking today about Syria, the developments there, with Mahdi Nazimroyo, who writes for globalresearch.ca, pardon me, and it's very important to go to Global Research. They're one of the best people, best organizations for following this, the fighting and the issues in the Middle East. We are once again being let down, as you, in total, complete, wall to wall by our mainstream media, who work at finding issues that have nothing to do with the actual events. So we're going to be asking Mahdi about developments, and we'll even ask him what's going on in Turkey, because we know he knows. And we'll also be talking today at about 5:30 with Joel Richardson. That's joelrichardson.com. Joel is a Toronto artist and a muralist. And if you go, you pass through Toronto's upper underpasses in the west end of the city, you often find his murals. So we'll ask him to identify all of his murals, among other things. But you're going to talk about the issue of developers in Toronto and the resistance of populations within the city to some of their plans, and his plan to try to set a world record, a Guinness Book of Records. Is that what it is? Guinness, yes, Book of Records, on the number of people engaged wearing suits and meditating to bring about a reversal of policy on development. I bet that's an awkward statement of what he's actually going to do. But we'll find out what Joel Richardson is doing. And it's going to be, I do know the date, it's going to be June the 9th, if you want to circle that right now. June the 9th is going to be something big planned by Joel. But we'll find out about that at 5:30. I'll just say that about how important this Syria story is, I think there's a sense that it's coming to some sort of it's coming to some sort of turn. The Russians and the Americans are planning to have a meeting that was scheduled for June. I'm hearing now that it's going to be there is talk that it may move it to July, and that's because the French are very uncomfortable with what's going on. The French are trying to delay this. They're hoping that they can sort of change the agenda a little bit, because they have been trying to bring about the downfall of Assad, and they're not too confident that the meeting as scheduled is going to achieve that. They had such great success in Libya, that, and they hope to replicate it in Syria, but it doesn't look like they're going to be able to do that. But there's also the issues of what kind of war it is, and we're going to be joined shortly by Mahdi, who explained to us that. But I'm concerned that I saw the Toronto Star had coverage where they quoted an imam from Qatar, and his language was utterly inflammatory and sectarian. And the Star quoted him without any negative comment. They just quoted him. But we got the man who knows the answers to all these things. That's Mahdi Nazimroyo. Are you there, Mahdi?
Hi, I'm here.
Hey, it's really great to be talking to you. That's a wonderful article published in globalresearch.ca. I hope everybody turns to it. The title of your piece had to do with focused on the issue of Israel's involvement. Maybe just start with that one. Every day, when I check the Mideast press, I pretty much give up on the Globe and the Star. I tend to go to them second. But there are overflights of Lebanon on a daily basis, and apparently lately they've become more intense. Could you start us off with that subject? What is Israel doing? Why are they so involved there?
Well, I want to be clear and frank about the flights over Lebanese airspace that the Israelis have been conducting. These have been going on for years. They've been illegal, and the United Nations has done nothing about them, even though they're a breach of Lebanese sovereignty, international law, and a threat to regional and international security. Now, Israel has been using Lebanon to attack Syria, three cases recently. But I want to also add that Jordan has allowed the Israelis to use its airspace against Syria, and that's for the purpose of using unmanned aerial drones. So the Israelis have, what my point is the Israelis have regularly been doing this against Lebanon, but now they're using Lebanon to attack Syria. So that's the first thing. The Lebanese president and the Lebanese government, the government that's the custodial government, have made complaints about what the Israelis are doing, about how the Israelis are trying to use Lebanon as a means of attacking Syria. Historically, I also want to point out that Lebanon has been used as a beachhead against Syria. In fact, one coup in the past was organized in Beirut against Syria, and this is before the Assad family came into power. Historically, Lebanon has been used as a place for plots against the Syrians. So, those are two important points I want to point out. And Israel is very involved. We can look at Fox News, for example, which is very biased in favor of Israel. They've shown footage of Israeli commandos, troops, coming back from Syria. They were inside Syria. We know the Israelis have been providing weapons to the anti-government forces. A vehicle was caught inside Syria. We know that the Israelis have been pushing for NATO involvement, the United States attack. They want an international war against the Syrians and their regional allies. They've pushed for no-fly zones. They've coordinated with Turkey. In fact, the row, the diplomatic row over the Marmara, the Turkish ship that went to Palestine, Gaza specifically, that row is over now, and it's because of Syria, because Israel is coordinating with the Turks against Syria. In fact, after its latest attacks in May against Syria, the Turkish and Israeli militaries went on the border with Syria.
Let me, by the way, just ask you, Mahdi, about that point, because we see that Erdogan, I guess is how you say it, is having a lot of problems. But isn't some of that related to his climb down over the Marmara, where he actually, many people were impressed that he looked like he was going to make an issue of it. And then he just went into an utter tailspin, which is rather humiliating to Turkey, I assume.
Okay, about the Mavi Marmara, Prime Minister Erdogan was a total hypocrite about it. He's been using the Palestinian cause to increase his popularity in Turkey and in the Arab world. That's all it was he used Turkish blood and the blood of activists to basically bring his popularity up. I've on the record questioned Turkish sincerity, even as far back as then. I remember when at Davos, Prime Minister Erdogan accused the Israelis of crimes and everything, and he walked out, and everybody in Turkey was very happy.
Yes.
But he said, let's kick Israel out of the United Nations. That's what he was saying, and I knew it was bravado, because if he really wanted to diplomatically hurt Israel, he would have cut Turkish ties with Israel back then and kicked the Israeli ambassador out of the Turkish capital, Ankara.
Yes.
Instead, he just says the UN, something he has no power about. All this is posturing on the part of the AKP government, Erdogan's
government. It must be
costing
his credibility, right? I mean, at a certain point, Turks are, they're sort of, he pulls them in one direction, and when he doubles back, they must get awfully tired of that routine.
Well, they're tired of a lot of things. Like, for example, Turkey has the most journalists in the world that are under arrest. It's one of the countries with the most journalists in the world. Civil liberties have been under attack in Turkey for many, many years. Since 2011, there's been massive arrests of activists in Turkey that the media here won't report about, and Erdogan's been behind it. He's figuratively attacked and threatened the Turkish press that's been pro-Syrian, saying that Turkish policy against Syria is wrong, that the prime minister is lying, these things have not happened in Syria. Him and his foreign minister and other members of the AKP government have figuratively threatened him and given them very hard times. There is still martial law in parts of eastern Turkey. It's not something of the past. That's still going on. The military courts are still present in eastern Turkey. There was dissent in the military against his policies. That's why many senior officers were arrested. What we're seeing right now in Istanbul, it's an accumulation of all this anger. Erdogan represents, above all, crony capitalism in Turkey. He's always been pro-business. In fact, the type of Islamism him and his party have promoted has always been subordinate to capitalism. They've always wanted a form of Islam, political Islam, subordinate to capitalism. And that's what that neo-Ottoman policy is. In fact, it's very ironic and very symbolic of what's going on in Turkey, because those protests are about saving the last green space in Istanbul, which I think you need a square. It's a place of protest. That square was one of the last open spaces and green spaces in Istanbul. He wanted to set up an Ottoman-style barrack mall there, okay? And that symbolizes neo-Ottoman policy, which is really a capitalist policy of expanding Turkish economic influence in the region. Even their prior zero problems policy, the zero problems with their neighbors, was based on intensifying economic links. It was capitalist motives. The AKP really is subordinated to capitalism in Turkey, Turkish capitalism and global capitalism. In fact, I this might be anecdotal, but when his daughter got married, Erdogan's daughter got married, you know, one of the guests of honor at the wedding was a big capitalist from Italy who used to be their prime minister, who's gone to jail. These are the type of people that Erdogan associates with. And everything that's happening in Syria is because of Turkish business interest. And unfortunately, everything's blown back in his face. Number one, terrorism has come into Turkey. For example, the bombings in the town on the border, we now know because of a group in Turkey, activist group called Red Hack, that the Turkish government knew those attacks were going to take place and let them take place and wanted to frame Syria for them. This document is from Turkey. The Interior Ministry knew this, and it blew back in Erdogan's face. The minorities are upset with his policies, the presses, the liberals, even the Islamists there. Mm-hmm. Now there's this diverse coalition against him and his heavy-handed tactics. Erdogan is losing popularity. His Syria policies are very disliked, and they've hurt Turkey's economy. Because Turkey's trade with the Arab world, most of it went through Syria. He's ruined ties with Iraq as well, and this is where Turkish transport vehicles would transport Turkish goods into the Arab world from. And there was major trade with Syria. It's all gone. And in fact, the Turkish government's been caught being involved with taking industrial weapons out of Aleppo. Industrial factory parts. They've basically stolen from the factories in Aleppo. Yes. They've been smuggling all the things out. So now the EU, the European Union has economic problems, and Erdogan has shot himself in the foot with his neighbors. So Turkey's economy is starting to hurt. His attack on the press and activists is blowing back in his face, and everybody realizes that this man, this prime minister, it works for capitalism.
Yeah. By the way, this is Mahdi Nazimroya. The article is in Global Research. .ca. It's there, a top article today about this crisis around Syria. Can you tell us what do you make of first of all, they're supposed to have a conference it was scheduled for June, but now I'm hearing they're going to move it again to July, and that they say that the French are causing a problem because they're afraid that maybe Assad's going to survive, and they're hoping to find something new to throw at him. What do you think of this conference scheduled by the Kerry and the the Russian, I keep calling them Soviet, the Russians. What do you make of this conference? Will it have any impact, or will it just be a side issue?
Well, I think Sergei Lavrov and the Russian side are very sincere about the conference. They're more sincere, at least, than the Americans, for sure. Secretary of State now, Kerry, and the Obama administration. Now it's for the British, for the French as well as the British. The United States is just hiding behind those two junior partners. Mm-hmm. Just like in Libya, it pushes the French and the British ahead, and it acts from behind the scenes. Mm-hmm. This is these decisions are being made in Washington. Its junior partners are just acting them out. so there's not that much pressure against the United States, and the U.S. doesn't look that bad. Of course, U.S. adventurism and intervention in countries in the last decade has made it look extremely bad, and that's why it pushes other countries, other international actors like the French and the British to do the talking, or to talk about sending weapons. It's the French and the British that pushed for the end of the EU weapons embargo to Syria.
Mm-hmm.
But it's very important to know that the Geneva II conference that's going to take place in Switzerland, the United States is only doing this because the insurgents have lost. The internal pressure in Syria is about, it's about gone. So they're
running out of foreign mercenaries.
Yeah, they've run out of foreign. That's why they're sending weapons. That's why the U.S. at the same time of where it declares that it wants a peace conference for a political and diplomatic solution, is saying we're going to send lethal weapons now to the insurgents. They know their insurgents have lost. The insurgents were one of their cards. That card is gone now, so they're going to try to get what they can out of Syria diplomatically. The U.S. has nothing in Syria. Mm-hmm. What it's trying to do is maximize its gains. That's the only reason Washington is negotiating. If Washington was winning, forget about negotiations. The United States, as an imperial power, as an empire, does not negotiate. It only negotiates when it's losing, and that's to keep as much ground as it
can. And buy time. Yeah.
I'm sorry, I didn't hear that.
Oh, I said to buy time.
It's buying time, but it's trying to see if it can organize or push for some sort of government where some of its agents in Syria or its agents outside of Syria are part of that government, and so it makes gains. The U.S. wants to maximize gains in Syria. So far, it has no gains. It's gotten no ground in Syria, and that's the only reason why it's at the Geneva II conference. It's trying to get something out of it. It will never do anything if it wasn't going to get anything out of it. And their internal option is gone, so now the external option is being used, and that's why you see the Israelis attacking Syria, bombing, trying to cause disillusion and chaos and fear, and the Turks are saying the Syrians are behind the terrorist attacks in our country. That's the external pressure. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, Geneva II is basically, I don't expect much to come out of it. They're going to try to make the same demand. And in fact, because of their loss, that's why they pushed the UN Security Council to pass that resolution against Syria, that totally biased and one-sided resolution against the violence in Syria, and you can tell where the rest of the world stands. The countries that voted alongside Israel and the United States, Britain and France, those are part of the American imperial system of empire. Mm-hmm. And the ones who voted against it or abstained, which is, I believe, 70 countries, mm-hmm. are the ones with independent foreign policies. Those are countries like Russia, Iran, China, these are Brazil, India. These are countries that are not puppets or vassals of the U.S.
Yeah. This is Mahdi Nazimroya. And Mahdi, of course, they're also trying to, now they found another foreign problem, and it's Hezbollah of Lebanon. And they say, oh, now this thing might spread. But I see commentary, of course, from the Middle East. All the journals there say, well, of course, it spread 2 years ago. I mean, in Tripoli, they've been running arms and fighters, mercenaries, into Syria. They've been attacking Lebanese, actually. Can you talk about that?
Well, Tripoli al-Shams, which is Tripoli in Lebanon, has been used from the very beginning in 2011. Lebanon was involved from the get-go. You have two camps in Lebanon. One of them is basically subordinate to Saudi Arabia and the United States and pro-Israeli at the same time. That's the Hariri March 14th camp. The March 14th camp includes the Future Party, the Falangists, who are known for their atrocities against Palestinian women and children, which includes rape and murder and collaborating with the Israelis. These groups, from the very beginning, were helping send arms in. They were using sectors of the Lebanese state to infiltrate Syria and to create a forward base in Lebanon against them. So from the very beginning, they were involved, and they've been exposed. One of the members of the Future Party, a member of parliament for Saeed Hariri's Future Party, he's been caught sending weapons through Turkey and coordinating with Turkish and Qatari intelligence. And it's really funny. When they did catch him, they have audio evidence of it too. They one of his phone conversations was tapped. He says that Mr. Saeed Hariri is getting impatient, and yet when he made a press conference admitting his guilt, he said Hariri is not involved and that this was me acting as an individual. But they've been involved from the very beginning, and they've been they've been bigots against the Syrian people for years. They've always worked against the Syrian people, but now they're sending arms to anti-government forces, yeah. And Hezbollah is involved too, but they became involved much later than the other side in Lebanon, which is
The leader of Hezbollah gave a very important talk. Wouldn't it be helpful if the media in the West would just report what he said? Nasrallah made a very – I find the other day someone made it available on the Internet, and thank goodness the Internet exists. Thank goodness global research exists. But he explained very in detail. He said, we weren't looking for any trouble, but these guys, when they started this action against the Syrian government, they said, first we get Assad, and then we're going to get Hezbollah, and we're going to get the Shias, and we're going to get the Christians. He said, we're already threatened by them. What do you expect us to do?
They are threatened by them. In fact, if Syria should collapse, the next target is Lebanon. Lebanon was a target from the very beginning. Hezbollah is a target. So is the March 8th Alliance in Lebanon, which I want to point out includes Sunni Muslims, includes Catholic Christians, Orthodox Christians, and the Rus. In fact, all the minority groups in the Middle East, which includes the Shiites as well as the Christians, mm-hmm. are all very fearful of this project that's taking place in Syria, where you have these extremist, violent, totally intolerant, that are totally closed-minded, taking over countries. They don't want a Muslim Brotherhood government there. They would want to. Syria is a pluralistic country, so is Lebanon, and they want to keep it like that. Hezbollah is for strategic reasons, it felt under threat. But it also knows that Lebanon's the next target. Yes. In fact, they've been targeting Hezbollah from the very beginning. They started shooting into Lebanon. They've been trying to target it in the media, saying it was involved when it wasn't. Then Nasrallah allowed Hezbollah fighters on their own initiative as individuals if they wanted to volunteer in Syria. And that's because Shiites were being targeted. The towns on the Lebanese-Syrian border, which are mixed Lebanese and Syrian, were being attacked. Lebanese travelers were being kidnapped. Shiite shrines in Syria were being attacked. So he let them volunteer and then officially got involved because it was very clear that the anti-government forces were going to target Hezbollah next. Mm-hmm. This is a regional war we're seeing in Syria. Syria is a front for a regional war, which includes Iran, includes Hezbollah, includes Russia, against the United States, Turkey, NATO, Jordan, mm-hmm. Qatar, Saudi Arabia, as well as Israel, if I didn't mention it. Mm-hmm. There's a regional war, and you can see that.
You should be inclusive. We'll make sure we get them all.
Yeah, it's a very big, and the Chinese, of course, support the Syrians, because China is a target of this at the end of the day. There's a lot of natural gas, an immense amount of natural gas in the eastern Mediterranean, and China is going to be the primary benefactor of that natural gas because most probably once the Iran-Iraq-Syria pipeline is built, it will be connected to the Iran-Pakistan gas pipeline, which will go to China, and this will be a huge geopolitical victory for the Chinese and their allies. And I think this is a really important aspect of this story that a lot of people miss, that just like how the previous wars in the Middle East, which included Iraq, were about oil, this war in Syria is also about geopolitics, but it's also about natural gas. It's about mm-hmm. energy.
Uh-huh. Yes, by the way, the Chinese are always being vilified, but their main strategic weapon is that they're patient and they don't send their armies. That they seem to know how to think.
Well, they don't want an empire of blood. I don't think the Chinese want an empire of blood. You can say whatever you love or hate the Chinese.
Sounds like the Enlightenment.
An empire, it's not going to be an empire of blood like the United States. It's going to. They just all they do is they're patient and they buy out, and they don't try to change any local politics in any country they do business with at all.
That's yeah. That, the Americans, the British think that's their job, is changing, improving everyone. This is Mahdi Nazim Roya. Now, Mahdi, there is something I was reading in the Associated Press item, and it was in the Toronto Star, and this is what kind of alarms me about reporting here. They quote a leading imam from Doha, and he's also apparently someone who appears on Al Jazeera.
Yes, that extremist. Yes,
yeah,
yes.
Now, and he says, everyone who has the ability and has training to kill is required to go, that is, go and join the rebels. And he says he denounced Assad's Alawite sect as an offshoot of Shiite Islam as more infidel than Christians and Jews. Now, what's this doing in a Toronto Star? I mean, why is, you know, we break off relations with Syria when the Syrian government never uses sectarian language at all. They won't allow it.
No.
But here we are in a Toronto Star quoting a leading imam who is listing Shiite is Muslims, Christians, and Jews, and urging people to go kill.
He's been doing this for years. He's an Egyptian originally, but he's an honorary citizen of Qatar. He's affiliated to Al Jazeera. He's a member of the Muslim Brotherhood.
Yeah.
And this man, he's a televangelist, basically, does whatever the Emir of Qatar tells him to do. He's very silent when Palestinians are being killed recently. In fact, when there was fighting between Israel and Gaza, he was silent. He didn't say anything. In fact, none of these people said anything. But when it comes to Syria, it becomes a religious duty. He doesn't speaking in theological terms, he doesn't know what he's talking about, because Jews and Christians are not infidels for Muslims.
Of course not.
But this man is a televangelist. Mm-hmm. That he's only there to create sedition, hate, and there's political motivation behind what he says. He's also said there should be a new jihad against the Russians. He's saying Russia is the number one. Why are the Russians all of a sudden have become the number one enemy of Muslims, according to this man? And he's saying that we should target the Russians. The Arab world has to target the Russians after the Syrians, as well as the Iranians, of course. What he says about Alawites is hateful. It represents part of the sectarian nature of the anti-government forces, where their supporters, their cheers are like this. Alawites to the ground and Christians to Lebanon. It means that the Alawites have to all be executed or killed,
yes.
And the Christians must be.
And this isn't gossip in a refugee camp somewhere. This is a guy on television, and he's in a country which Canada embraces.
Oh, yes, of course. We embrace Saudi Arabia, Qatar. We don't have any problems with their human rights. Even when one of our own citizens was raped, brutally raped, and held arbitrarily, our government did nothing for him. In fact, it was the British embassy that helped him get out with their nationals before he was going to be beheaded. Like Saudi Arabia, the kingdom of horrors is what it should be called. This country is supported by Mr. Harper. He has no problem about their human rights records. He has problems with the human rights records of countries that are not on our side. And speaking about our press, as well as I guess North American, Western European press, the language is very sectarian. If we look at it critically, whenever they speak about Syria, they always have to say Alawite regime, offshoot of Shiaism, linked to Iran.
Right.
But that's not true. It's a very pluralistic government. It's not. You can't typecast it as an Alawite regime. The vice president is a Sunni Muslim. You have Christian cabinet ministers. In fact, the deputy prime minister who was assassinated in terrorist bombing, as well as the defense minister, the Greek Orthodox Christian. Most of the cabinet ministers are actually Sunni Muslims. Most of the parliament is Sunni Muslim. So to say that this country, this government is an Alawite regime, and because of this, Hezbollah and Iran are supporting it, is totally wrong.
I'm really glad you put your finger on that, because they claim to be talking about sectarianism while they're fanning the flames.
They're the ones who want sectarianism. They want a sectarian Middle East where Christians can't live with Muslims, where Shiites can't live with Sunnis. Let's look at historically a country the United States has intervened in, Iraq. What happened in Iraq? What happened in Iraq is what they're trying to do in Syria. all of a sudden, the country, there was a cleansing of areas. The mixed Shiite Sunni Christian neighborhoods disappeared. Mm-hmm. Now there were Shiite neighborhoods and Sunni neighborhoods because there was armed gangs attacking the mixed neighborhoods. The mixed Arab and Kurdish neighborhoods disappeared. This is what they want. They want to get rid of pluralistic areas in the Middle East and turn everyone against each other. Yeah. The United States helped, with, as well as the British, during the Anglo-American occupation, which was illegal, of Iraq. They helped create this sectarianism. They pushed for sectarian political parties. And now they want to do the same thing in Syria, and they've been working to do the same thing in Lebanon. They want a sectarian war. They want to eliminate the Christian presence in the Middle East, and they want Shiites and Sunnis to go at each other's throats. It's simple as that, and the Israelis stand there loving every aspect of it. In fact, the Israeli members of the Israeli government have said, specifically the military, have said, we don't care about Al-Qaeda. Al-Qaeda is not a threat to us. We don't mind if Al-Qaeda even takes over Syria. You know, this says a lot about their stance on all this.
Well, Mahdi Nazemroev, it's been very enlightening and encouraging, actually. And we really appreciate your articles, globalresearch.ca, and we thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you for having me. It's always a pleasure.
Oh, thank you. Okay. Bye-bye. This is the Taylor Report, CIUT 89.5 FM. We'll take a quick break and come back. We'll talk to Joel Richardson.